I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ross Hammond. He is a senior fellow in economics, and he's director of the Center on Social Dynamics and Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. It is sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, obesity is an epidemic in the United States. It's an epidemic in other countries as well. And it's not only a health issue, it's an economic problem. Describe to us the scale of the obesity problem.
Sure. Well, now, at the present time in the United States, 2 in 3 adults are overweight, and 1 in 3 are obese. And among children, 1 in every 3 is overweight. And being obese or overweight is associated with much higher health risks for many, many diseases, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, several kinds of cancers, hypertension, high cholesterol, asthma, arthritis, and the list goes on and on.
Why asthma? Why arthritis?
Well, the pathways are actually quite complex biologically that connect overweight with those diseases, but I think it's fairly well established that there is an increased risk for both of those conditions from being obese or overweight.
And so this becomes, just simply because of the healthcare costs and other reasons as well, a real economic problem here in this country.
That's right. It's a major driver of healthcare costs. By one estimate, 21% of all U.S. medical spending at the present time is driven by the obesity epidemic. Medical spending among the overweight and obese can be from 36 to 100% higher than people who have a healthy weight. One of the most troubling things is the extreme early onset of chronic diseases that used to occur only later in adulthood. So many children are now developing type 2 diabetes
right
in childhood, which used to be called adult onset diabetes. By one estimate, one-third of all children born today in the United States will develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. And among African Americans and Hispanics, that's 1 in every 2 children.
Among African Americans and Hispanics, the rate is higher. Why is that?
The rate is higher, but it's actually higher only in certain gender and socioeconomic groups, and the reasons for that are fairly complex. But what's important to understand about obesity here in 2014 is that this is now something that affects every category of society in the United States. It's no longer a disease of the poor and disenfranchised, but really something that affects everyone.
How is the obesity problem now compared to the way it was, say, 50 years ago?
Oh, it's completely different. The rates of obesity have really skyrocketed just in the last 20 or 30 years, and medical spending on conditions related to obesity has followed a parallel trend. One of the things that I think is interesting to look at is the different kinds of costs that are associated with overweight and obesity, because it's not just direct medical spending, although that is a major driver, but there's also quite a bit of indirect costs that comes from absenteeism and presenteeism on disability. Those can add up to, by some estimates, $66 billion a year.
Presenteeism?
And presenteeism, where you're at work, but you're less effective and productive than you would otherwise have been. And then there are also some other less intuitive costs that have to do with the extra fuel that it takes to move heavier people around the country.
And that actually adds up to maybe as much as
$3 billion a year.
You get lower gas mileage, that kind of thing?
Yes, and planes have to change their weight allocation and burn more fuel. Ambulances have to be reconfigured to allow for heavier patients. You need 4 people on the stretcher instead of 3, maybe, et cetera, et cetera.
So far when I ask you why questions, you say, well, it's very complex. But now you have to tell us why is it skyrocketed so much in the last 20, 30 plus years?
Well, that's the big question, and I don't think there's a definitive answer yet to that. And I think that probably there is no single answer for what has caused the obesity epidemic. In one sense, obesity is very simple because it's about energy balance. If you take more energy in than you consume, you'll gain weight. But the things that drive energy balance are themselves very intricate. They involve biology, genetics, neurobiology, the brain, prices, our physical and social environments, the media. And all of these things are interacting, which makes it very difficult to pinpoint a single cause. And there are also multiple pathways to obesity. Some of these factors matter more for some people than for others. So I think one of the most important things to know about obesity is that there is likely no single explanation for what caused the epidemic. And therefore, there's also likely no single solution that fits all circumstances, contexts, ages, needs. And so I think a lot of energy has been invested in looking for a magic bullet that will solve this crisis. And I don't think there is one. I think we need a package of coordinated solutions.
Well, if you were to say, okay, there's not one single cause, but there's a half a dozen good candidates, which taken together begin to paint a picture of the cause, what are some of those elements?
Well, some of the elements that certainly seem to be important are changing food environment, the vast increase in readily affordable, inexpensive, accessible calories that are ubiquitous in our current environment, advertising, particularly advertising of food aimed at children, which is investment in that industry has expanded considerably, changes in our physical environment, longer commute times, less time available for people to prepare food, less emphasis on cooking at home and more on eating out. All of these undoubtedly play a role, but I think it's pretty hard to argue that any one of them is the only cause.
What about in children? I mean, are you looking at things like kids not getting PE and not getting recess and stuff like that?
Yeah, some of those things are important as well. I think there's a lot of a growing body of evidence that the most important effects that lead to later obesity occur before age 5. So it's actually in very young children that we think now that a lot of the important action is. And obesity is something that's much, much easier to prevent than it is to reverse. And for this reason, an emphasis on early childhood and on prevention has become a very important focus of this field.
What kinds of things are you seeing with children under the age of 5? I mean, are they feeding children Hershey bars? I mean,
no, it has a lot to do with how preferences form and habits during that age period. Preferences for different kinds of food, what you think tastes good, what you seek out later in life. There's also a bunch of biological programming that's going on during that age group. And actually, we now know that exposures that happen in utero that are based on the mother's environment and the mother's food and consumption patterns are passed on to the kids.
Now, one thing that is very important to talk about and that you know a great deal about is the food system itself. We have a huge amount of wheat, corn, soy, and rice produced, I believe, with heavy subsidies, taxpayer subsidies, in the United States of America. Those constitute a very large percentage of the calories that people consume. Meanwhile, we don't produce enough fruits and vegetables to even meet the minimum daily suggestions.
Right.
So there's a big problem there in the beginning.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think there are two important things to know about that. One of those is that the current configuration of the U.S. food system and certainly public policy that drives some of that food system really originated during the Dust Bowl era in the United States, when there was widespread concern about famine here in the United States and the desire for a system that would produce as many calories as possible and have them be cheap and affordable and calorie dense. And the system is very good at that. That's in fact achieved that objective. We no longer think very much about famine, widespread famine here in the U.S., but there's been a side effect of that, and obesity is arguably one of the signs of that side effect. The other thing that's important to know about the food system, though, is that it's a very interconnected system, and almost anything that you would like to optimize, there are trade-offs elsewhere in the system. So producing more fruits and vegetables might carry other costs in terms of human rights, of labor, of immigration policy, and of other kinds of health, like exposure to pesticides or exposure to biological disease-inducing agents that you would have to think through to decide what the right balance is.
One of the things that I've become so aware of recently is that every single thing that we're dealing with today, for example, climate change, is the result of something that was at one time considered a great improvement in our social life. I mean, to have appliances that we use, we never thought that they'd, you know, warm the planet to the point where we are extincting species and so on. We just thought this is great. And this seems to be another example of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to a certain extent, trade-offs between competing goals that you'd like to get out of a dynamic system that's interconnected like this are maybe unavoidable. But I think what we can do is try to make those trade-offs more apparent and to make more conscious choices about how we'd like to balance those trade-offs. A lot of the things that you're talking about now, from global warming to obesity, are in some sense unintended consequences. They weren't things that people anticipated ahead of time and made a conscious choice to proceed anyway with full knowledge of what those trade-offs might be. So a lot of our focus at the center that I direct at Brookings is on using computational models, artificial societies, to help us think through what those trade-offs are ahead of time so that we can make more informed choices as a society.
We're talking to Ross Hammond of the Brookings Institution about obesity. Now, when you talk about approaches to the obesity epidemic and the kinds of models that you're building there, it's things that most of us have never seen or even imagined, but it's a kind of computer modeling. What are you looking at? What kind of inputs are you doing, and what are they telling you so far?
Sure. Well, we're using models, computational models, in really two different ways. We're using them to try to understand these complex and interrelated drivers of what's leading to obesity, as well as to try to understand what works and how we can take what's worked in some places and translate it to others. And so we're using these two different modes of modeling. And the models themselves you can think of as artificial societies, as laboratories for exploring and understanding policies and the consequences those policies might have in the real world, except we're doing it in computers first, just like a biologist might develop a drug in a petri dish in their lab first before doing human trials in the real world. So it's a similar kind of process. And what we're learning are two things. The first is this idea I alluded to earlier that there's unlikely to be a single cause, and that a sufficient understanding of what drives obesity probably involves looking across several different moving pieces. Social norms are important, the physical environment is important, and our biology. Both our neurobiology and our genetics and physiology are important, and these things are interacting with each other in ways that we really need to understand to get the best possible handle on this. On the side of what we can do about it, I think there's an emerging sense in the field of people who study obesity that we are learning some real tangible lessons, and that one of those is because of all these things that are connected, that are driving obesity, we really need solutions that are also connected, that are coordinated solutions, so-called systems approaches that cover many different pieces of the system at once, that do many coordinated actions at once. So to give you a concrete example to help illustrate this, imagine that you do nutrition education in the schools, and children go to the grocery store with their parents knowing what is a healthy food and what kinds of healthy diets, what comprises a healthy diet. But there's no nutrition labels on the food. They're going to have a hard time making healthy choices, even if they know what those healthy choices should be. Similarly, if you have nutrition labeling or menu labeling, but you don't have education about what constitutes a healthy choice, then the nutrition labels may not do very much. But together, these two policies, which are in different spheres of activity, one in education and one in economic policy, they can work very powerfully together. Similarly, if you imagine supporting healthy eating and activity for children across multiple positions that they occupy during the day, at daycare, at school, if you focus only on school, then kids may eat healthily at school, but then go home and eat lots of junk food, or go to daycare and eat lots of junk food. So you have to sort of cover many different pieces of the system at once. So the other two things I would say that we're learning that are really, I would say overall we have five general lessons that we know about what works in obesity prevention. And one of these is this idea of coordinated multi-factor approaches that I just described. The second, which I think is becoming increasingly apparent, is that the community level is a really important place to intervene to try to address obesity. It's something that is much easier to develop from the bottom up, to have grassroots movements for change across the United States. It's simultaneously a high enough level of scale that you can make significant and widespread changes in things like zoning or education policy, but it's close enough to the individual level that you can have a lot more stakeholder engagement, and you can break through a lot of the barriers that separate the Department of Education from the Department of Transportation from the Farm Bill, which at the federal level are very difficult to connect, but at the community level are much easier. The third thing is this focus on early prevention that I talked about a bit earlier. The fourth is where a lot of attempts to address obesity fall down is really in the process of implementation. So it's not enough to know the changes that, if we made them successfully, would help prevent obesity. We have to think about how to make those changes and how to make those changes easy for communities, how to make them possible for communities, and how to actually implement the choices. And a lot of attention is being paid on doing research in that area. And the final thing I'll say is the power of the social, an emphasis on social norms, on perceptions, on marketing, and how important in our choices as individual people in the United States the social context is, particularly where eating is concerned.
What is the role of poverty? I mean, we know that junk food is cheaper than healthy food, and pesticide-laden food is cheaper than organic food and things like that. What is the role of poverty in obesity?
Well, again, it's a bit subtle. It used to be the case that obesity rates were much higher among the poor, and that's still true to a certain extent, although as I think it's important to stress that obesity is now something that affects every class and category of Americans.
But middle class obesity is going up rather than poor obesity going down?
Well, there's if you aggregate to look across all genders, all races, all socioeconomic groups, then it's very difficult. You mask a lot of heterogeneity, a lot of diversity. So in fact, for example, among African Americans, in men, the rates of obesity are not that different from white men. But among women, they're very different. From African-American women and white women are very different rates. So there's an interaction there. Similarly, there are interactions, which are hard to describe in a few sentences, between income, race, and obesity. But there is some new evidence that's particularly troubling that just came out a couple weeks ago, that although it is true that childhood obesity rates are leveling off on average in the United States, there's a huge disparity that's opening up where rates in children in the poorest quintiles of income are continuing to accelerate, while rates in the wealthiest quintiles are in fact declining. So on average, they look like they're leveling out, but there's actually a widening gap. And that may have implications for things like social mobility that we care about also.
And I know you're just going to say it's too complex to tell us, but I mean, can you help us to understand why among that quintile rates of obesity are going up so much?
Well, I think obesity is in some ways an outcome of many different kinds of disadvantages that people may experience. Some of the pathways to obesity involve higher exposure to targeted advertising, lack of access to healthy alternatives or the ability to afford healthy alternatives, a social context in which your patterns, the patterns around you that you model on for eating are mostly unhealthy. The habits that you learn as a child may be unhealthy.
Yeah, I mean, habit must be such a huge part of it.
It is a huge part of it. It is a huge part of it. When obesity starts to become entrenched, there are both very strong biological mechanisms, but also very strong behavioral mechanisms like habit that make it very difficult to reverse. But I think the theme I'm going to keep repeating over and over is that because there are so many different pathways to obesity, that if you take five obese people, the thing that was most important for each of those five people in becoming obese may be totally different things. And so it's very difficult to generalize. So the list I'm giving you is sort of a list of, in general, disadvantages about social capital, about access, about the environmental context, the social context, advertising context. Those are all things that in general are correlated with being poorer in the United States. And all of those are things that can lead to obesity or help promote an obesogenic trend.
What about trauma? I know that, for example, rape and sexual abuse can often lead to eating disorders. Is that something that you factor in as well?
That's not something I spend a lot of time doing research on, although there is some good evidence that the brain systems that are involved in eating disorders and in obesity are actually very similar. They're the same systems that become out of equilibrium in different directions.
I think of that because, again, when you talk about the interrelationship of all of these things, sometimes there is a connection between poverty and abuse and crime and trauma, and so you have an indirect connection between poverty and obesity in through that mechanism.
Sure. I mean, there are many, and we could have a very long list. The list would also include fewer opportunities to engage in physical activity in neighborhoods where it's not safe to go outside and where you can't afford a gym membership.
Or where it's perceived as unsafe to go outside.
They also, there's a fairly rich relationship that's not fully understood yet between stress and obesity, and certainly higher levels of cortisol, which is a measure of stress, can be documented in minority people, in particularly in inner city contexts where they're surrounded by an environment that's very stress inducing, and so on and so forth. We could have quite a long list. And what no one really knows is, on a population level, what is the sort of which mixture of these things is the most prevalent driver of obesity. We don't really know that. All we know is that all of these can be important, and that for different people they matter to a different degree.
It's just so interesting to even contemplate, because you look at things like, you know, a significant increase in the minimum wage and kind of imagine plugging that into your model and seeing what kind of outcomes it might have on public health, including obesity.
Yes, I think that would be very interesting to look at.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's done that yet.
So do you look at countries where there is a very low rate of obesity and see how they live?
We do, although those countries are fewer and farther between than they used to be, because this really is a global epidemic. And one thing that you may not know is that actually there are more people who are overweight and obese in developing countries than just in terms of sheer numbers than there are in the developed world.
I know. I read that in your paper, and I was like, what's up with that? You have this sort of weird simultaneous or juxtaposition of malnutrition and obesity.
Yes, you can have side-by-side malnutrition and obesity in the same country, in the same village, and sometimes even in the same household. You will have a member of that household who's obese and a member who's malnourished, which helps illustrate why it's not just as simple as environmental conditions or access and prices to food. There's also social dynamics, which are quite important, which are at work.
So what's going on in developing countries?
Well, one of the things that's certainly going on in developing countries is that as countries become more wealthy, they have a nutrition transition where they eat more meat, they eat more processed food, they live in more urban environments, and increasingly they're exposed to more Western styles of markets and advertising. And all of those things can contribute to growing obesity rates.
Which, in the minds of probably many of them, is considered an improvement over what they had before.
Sure, and there's actually a very important dimension, again, that's social in nature to think about, which is that for much of human history, being overweight or obese was actually a sign of prosperity, because it shows that you can afford excess, and that's a social signal that's very important still in some developing countries.
But what about European countries? I mean, we think of France. Again, I'm not speaking to you as a researcher, but just as an observer, you go to places like Paris that I went to not all that long ago, where the women are fantastic and everybody walks around and eating butter and drinking wine and things like that, and they look great. And to see a really heavy person on the street is much more unusual than it is on the streets of, say, New York.
That was true much more so 15 years ago than it is now. France has quite a serious obesity epidemic of its own, particularly in children and youth. But there are some factors that are cultural in nature that do appear to be somewhat different between France and the United States that may help protect France from some of the obesity epidemic. Although, as I say, these things are themselves changing. So to give you an example, a sociologist did a study in which he tried to understand how many different things people were doing at once, how much multitasking they were doing, and what the environment of distractions looked like for people when they ate lunch every day. And what he found is that on average, American women are doing many different things at the same time while they're eating. They're talking on the phone, they're sitting at their desk, they're driving their car, they're yelling at their kids, they're doing whatever they're doing many things at once. Whereas French women are doing correspondingly quite a bit fewer things at the same time while they're eating. Basically, they're eating. Therefore, a lot more of their attention can be on the eating, on how the food tastes, on how much of it they're eating, on what it contains, than American women who might be more driven by the convenience offered by less healthy options. So that's a cultural difference about the significance of the midday meal, and the context for the midday meal, that isn't about economics per se. It's not about physical environments or advertising per se, it's really a cultural or social difference.
So if you pay attention to what you're eating, you're less likely to get fat?
Well, all other things being equal, and we have to keep saying that over and over in obesity because there are very few universal truths about obesity because of the diversity of pathways that can lead to obesity. But it is certainly the case that there's good evidence that people who eat very rapidly or while very distracted tend to consume more and less healthy alternatives than people who are paying more attention to what they're eating.
There must also be just the simple factor of, I mean, it's simple, but the factor of the food culture. If you have a culture that you grew up in which you appreciate, for example, fresh ingredients and how to cook them and what's now considered the slow food movement, which used to be just how everything was, because there was no fast food, you have that in places like France and Italy. Unless they're subsumed by the kind of invasion of American style fast food culture.
Well, some of those cultural norms are changing in Western European countries where you think of them traditionally being there. And certainly those kinds of differences can be important for obesity, although it's important also to remember that there are trade-offs and that the added convenience of spending less time cooking and shopping adds up to perhaps greater productivity and faster economic growth for Americans than is being experienced in Europe.
Yeah, and at the same time, productivity and economic growth benefiting who, considering that we have such an ever expanding gap between rich and poor here. So
Absolutely.
we're talking to Ross Hammond about obesity. He's a senior fellow in economics at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. So what does all this mean for ordinary people? I mean, you are making these models, and there's a great deal to be said about it. There is a level of complexity just on a scientific level that none of us are ever going to be able to really wrap our heads around, although there have been some good documentaries about obesity in America and so on. But what do we do with this information?
Well, I think the most important thing for people to do is to think about the choices they're making, to educate themselves about the implications of those choices for themselves and for their children, and then to make educated choices about what's best for them, given all of the diversity that we know is going on and given all the trade-offs that we've talked about. And there are increasing number of resources available out there at the Institute of Medicine, at the NIH, through the HBO miniseries, Weight of the Nation. There are lots of places people can go to find this information. And while we don't know all the answers yet, we do know a fair amount about what constitutes a healthy, balanced diet. And that may be easier for some people to achieve than others. The other thing I would encourage in people at the individual level to do is to get involved in their communities. And there are many grassroots community efforts underway to address how food is grown and made accessible to communities, to address obesity in schools and in children. And there are lots of good models for how communities can work together to address this more powerfully than any individual can, and in many cases more powerfully than the federal government is able to, given the gridlock in Washington.
If you imagined a really healthy system of what people bought when they went to buy their food, what was in the supermarket, and so on, you could imagine a system 10, 20, 30 years from now in which three quarters of the junk food sold just simply wasn't sold anymore. But that would be basically going up against big business, big food business.
Well, one of the things that the Institute of Medicine committee that I'm on now is thinking about, is tasked with thinking about, is what alternative configurations of the food system in the United States might look like and what some of the implications of those might be. And as you can imagine, that's a very involved process and we don't quite have answers yet.
Are there any large food producers that you're working with to address these questions?
Not personally.
Not
but there are people in the field who are working with the food industry and with food producers to try to find solutions that work for the entire system.
So you will be speaking tonight at the James A. Little Theater at 7:30 here in Santa Fe. It's a community lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. And will you be showing us a little bit more about how you do this science?
I will, yes.
Well, we look forward to seeing you. Ross Hammond is a senior fellow in economics and director of the Center on Social Dynamics and Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much for having me.